Welcome everybody. Tonight's class is on Parshas Vayishlach. The title of the class is Murder or Self-Defense, a Question of Narrative. Okay, so if you've been watching the news, the most significant thing happening in the Middle East was the assassination of the top Iranian nuclear scientist from all quarters. This was done by, Israel's not admitted to it, but assumed to be done by the Mossad, perhaps done with other anti-Iranian dissidents in the country. And basically, the person who was sort of the brain behind the operation of being able to not just have Iran have a nuclear power, but to take that uranium and bring it to the point where it can be enriched to a point where they can have nuclear devices, which of course they deny, but Israel pulled off a heist in 2018 with 1 million documents, most of them classified, which showed rather conclusively that that Iran had in fact an interest of not having a peaceful nuclear program, but rather with a nefarious intent to provide the material to produce a nuclear warhead or warheads, and therefore gain dominion in the Middle East. Okay, so I'm going to show you two quick clips of reactions, very different. One coming first from MSNBC, from a former FBI, and then we're going to hear from a former general on Fox News. Okay, we're going to listen carefully. We're going to do I'll do a little share screen, and I'll just go one to the other. We'll start off with the FBI former official. Let's go to the videotape.
Assistant Director for Counterintelligence at the FBI, Frank Figluzzi. Frank, I have been waiting all day to talk to you, my friend, so I appreciate you joining us this afternoon on this, because when I saw this news break yesterday, having been a reporter covering Iran pretty extensively over the last couple of years, I was really troubled to see this, considering where we are with the administration here, the lame duck session we're in, and the possibility that the Biden administration could be angling towards getting into a new agreement with Iran. What could take place before then? First, give me your reaction to the killing yesterday, the assassination of Iran's top nuclear scientist.
So I look at national security decisions and foreign policy decisions this way, a lot like we all look at life decisions. You can do the right thing at the wrong time. You can do the right thing for the wrong reason. And then, worse of all, you could do the wrong thing at the wrong time for the very wrong reason. And so I'm concerned right now that this is what we're looking at with regard to this assassination. Without getting into the subtle nuances of whether this was an Israeli strike okayed or coordinated with the U.S., and we can talk about that and the experience and the short shelf life of Iranian nuclear science experts, but let's look at how we got here and where this is going. We got here because the Trump administration chose to tear up a treaty that was, by most accounts, working and was keeping Iran in check with regard to its nuclear program. We got here because this president seems hell-bent on tearing up the place before he leaves and turns things over to Biden. And where is this going? This is now making it extremely difficult for Iran to come back to the table, save face, and for Biden to re-execute a workable strategy for Iran.
Okay, that's narrative number one. Okay, so we're going to go to narrative number two. Let me get to the... Here we go.
...leader vowing definitive punishment for those involved in the assassination of one of Iran's top military scientists, believed to be linked to Tehran's nuclear program. This comes as the Pentagon orders the USS Nimitz back to the Persian Gulf, though claiming it was only deployed as a backup for troops being pulled out of Iraq and Afghanistan. Let's bring in now Fox News senior strategic analyst and retired four-star general Jack Keane to weigh in. General, good morning. As always, thank you for being here. So when you look at this assassination that we believe was likely done by the Israelis. What is the impact of this?
Well, I think clearly what they're trying to say, the Israelis, certainly they have intelligence that we're not privy to have publicly. Certainly the United States is sharing that with them. And the Israelis have always believed, and they had the evidence to prove it, that Iran really intends to build a nuclear weapon. They went into Tehran in 2018 in January and cleaned out a warehouse of classified information that they brought back to Tel Aviv, and it revealed absolutely that Iran is developing nuclear weapons, and they fully intend to, despite the nuclear deal. So that's really the issue here. What the Israelis have attempted to do, Pete, is below the level of conflict, delay the development of these weapons as much as possible. And it explains why there's explosions taking place all over Iran in the last year, to include one at Natanz, which is a uranium enrichment facility, and another is a missile production facility. Widely believed to be the Mossad doing this in an espionage campaign along with Iranian resistance groups. Why? To slow down the development of their nuclear enterprise.
Yeah, because, General, for Israel, it's existential. It may be academic for others, but Israel, Iran has said quite clearly what they would want to do with a nuclear weapon. Now, they're saying they're going to retaliate. Do you believe it'll be a significant retaliation or something that they can just use for internal propaganda to make it look like they did?
Well, I think the election certainly will have an impact on the Iranians. They never really significantly retaliated at Qasem Soleimani being killed by the Trump administration last January. And that is because they wanted to see the outcome of the election. Now what appears that we're heading towards a Biden presidency. And I believe they will meter their response, because the one thing they don't want to do is, with a new administration, so poison the well that they're not going to be able to get the sanction relief that they believe this administration will give them. So I suspect that will cause them to limit their response somewhat. They don't want to walk up the ladder of escalation to that degree with a new administration and therefore put any negotiated deal off the table. So,
all right. Okay, so we got two literally diametrically opposed understandings of what occurred this past Friday. Here we go. Let's go to the question. All right, so let's start off with some questions. Question number one: why does the former FBI official view the assassination of the Iranian scientist as the wrong thing at the wrong time, for the wrong reason? What's his rationale?
His rationale is that it doesn't allow the next administration to kind of take charge of the Iranian conflict.
Right. It will hamper already. President-elect Biden has already made clear that he wants to follow in his predecessor, Barack Obama's, footsteps and re-enter the Iranian deal. So this situation, this assassination, shall we say, and from their perspective, makes that situation much more harder and much more difficult to happen. Okay? So that's one belief. In other words, from a Biden re-entering negotiated deal with the Iranians, which will be only for 8 or 10 years, and therefore the removal of the, and in exchange for the removal of sanctions, that would, of course, this whole thing sets that opportunity back. Then we get number two on the Fox Channel. We got, why does retired General Keane view the assassination as the justifiable measure to reduce the existential threat of Iran producing an atomic weapon to be used against Israel?
Because the Israelis went into Iran and found all this documentation stating that Iran wasn't complying with the Iranian deal to begin with, and they were still continuing to work on nuclear weapons.
Exactly. In other words, from Israel's perspective, this is not, Israel is a country founded by Holocaust survivors. And when a country says, we're going to exterminate you. They take that very seriously, A. B, the Republic of Iran is a very sophisticated country of 25 million people, and they have, and they are very concerned that if Iran does get nuclear capabilities, they can then use that to blackmail, or basically threaten or destroy Israel. So they don't real, and they feel that you know, their perspective is that Barack Obama and Biden are being naive and optimistic, looking for you know, the Iran deal. So you have two very different assessments here of the exact same event. Same event. Somebody, the again, the former FBI official, obviously a very well-spoken person, views this as a terrible thing. General Keane, former U.S. General, views it as a justifiable and, quite frankly, a good thing. Okay, so we have two reads of the exact same facts. Now, so let me go to... so here's my... But let's go a little... This is as a preparation to our story. We'll go a little deeper here. Beyond slowing nuclear research, what deterrence is Israel gaining by assassinating Iran's top scientist in his bulletproof car near the capital of Iran in Tehran? What deterrence is being articulated to Iran? And furthermore, not only that, in addition, the explosion throughout their various military facilities, the injecting about a decade ago of the Stuxnet virus into their reactor, and stealing a million of their documents from that warehouse. What message, what deterrent is Israel hoping to achieve? In addition to slowing down the brains behind the project, what deterrent are they trying to put forth? Marvin? All right, Alan, want to share? Let's share the space. What deterrent is Israel putting forth over here? All right, Scott.
If you keep going down this road, we're going to keep responding in the way that we've been.
And specifically, if you're the leader in Iran, you're an Ayatollah, you're one of the leadership in Iran, which the military experts have sort of been amazed how Israel was able to pull this off in the heart of Iran. How well did you sleep that night?
Well, that's the whole thing. It's all based on fear that anybody who's involved with this project knows that they could be the next ones. And they know that Israel has a reach that goes into the country very, very deeply in ways that really we've not seen a lot of those kind of spy actions elsewhere around the world. So it's really a combination of strategies. Perhaps that's something that motivated the meeting between Netanyahu and Saudi Arabia because they clearly see that their main enemy, also Iran, is being dealt with by Israel.
Yes,
that
is correct. And right before I got on to the class thing, Iran apparently is pointing the finger at Saudi Arabia as somehow being a co-conspirator in this as well. So the situation is, but you're 100% correct. If you're Rouhani, one of the leader of Tehran, you know that the Mossad and all their allies have a very long arm, and if you're gonna do something which is viewed dangerous to Israel, they have no problem pulling the trigger when they need to. Okay, so that is part of it, because again, Israel is deeply concerned that a nuclear Iran would be could be another. In other words, the way that Bibi Netanyahu for the last got to be 20 years, has been going to the UN regularly and on the world stage in general, saying that basically this could be, God forbid, the next Holocaust of the Jews. Because if they're able to develop, and they also have developed a very significant missile program, in other words, a delivery system, all you need, Israel's, you know, we've all been to Israel. Israel's very small. Israel's size in New Jersey. If you're able to send 3-4 nuclear warheads to Israel, it's game over. That's it.
Interestingly, though, it's also game over to the Palestinians. The nuclear radiation doesn't know where to stop.
That's also true, but you get the feeling from the Israelis get the feeling that these people work from a different calculus, and they don't give a damn about if they feel that's in what they need to do, and they're going to die, and they'll offer up, and they'll lose 10 million people that might in a jihad-esque manner, that might be worth it in their theology. So that's the point. So the key element here is one part A, to sort of decapitate the brains of the project, A, and B is to communicate a message of deterrence, loud and clear. You mess with the Israelis, we're taking you down. We know where you live, and we have no problem doing it. Now, I don't know. We don't know if it's propaganda because Israel's not commenting, but apparently, a part or all of this assassination was done by remote control. In other words, the machine gun was apparently 500 feet away and was being directed in remote control fashion. And they had a bomb in the car. It was a very sophisticated thing, and which of course is shocking to the Iranians. But again, what that's true, were there other people there? This is something that we're going to find out maybe in 30 years. So unless your dad works for the Mossad, and even if he does, you're not going to know. So that's the deal. All right. This takes us to a very difficult and challenging story. So it does deal with rape and murder. This is not going down for the feel good class of the week, okay, guys? So I'm just warning you that. But we know this is an adult class so we're just going to try to deal with a lot of these issues here and deal with them in a thoughtful way. And I warned you. I just put on the Netflix PG-13 warning on there, okay? So here we go. Let's get into it. Let's go to the okay, so let me have somebody read. Let's have a quick summary. Let me have Marvin Baum read the chapter summary. The chapter 31 took him long. We can't read every sentence. We'll read some. Here's a summary. Make sure everybody gets the basic story. Go ahead.
Rashid 34 recounts Shechem's rape of Dina and his ensuing negotiations with Yaakov's family to marry Dina and fuse their two communities into one nation. When Dina's brothers conditioned this on the circumcision of all males of Shechem's city, Shechem himself hastens to oblige and persuades his people to follow suit. Shimon and Levi then take advantage of the post-circumcision infirmity of everyone in the city to slay Shechem, as well as all of his male compatriots, and Yaakov's sons proceed to despoil the city.
Okay, so that's the basic story, and then there's going to be a conversation between Shimon and Levi, the people who kill everybody, kill all the men, and Yaakov, okay? So let's get to the story. Marvin, you're doing a great job reading. Let's read. We're going to do this is called the Reader's Digest version of the story, okay? I left all the good parts in, don't worry.
Leah's daughter Dina, whom she had born to Jacob, went out to visit some of the local girls. She was seen by Shechem, son of the chief of the region, Hamor the Hivite, took her, lay with her, and afflicted her. Shechem said to his father Hamor, "Get me this young girl as a wife." Jacob learned that his daughter Dina had been defiled. His sons were in the field with livestock, and Jacob remained silent until they came home.
Okay, let's start. We're going to pause right now. So here's the situation. Leah went out innocently to go. Remember, in her family, how many other sisters are there?
None.
It's 12 boys, 12 guys, and four moms, and one girl. Okay, that's just, and Yaakov. Okay, that's the family. All right? So she goes out to check out what's going down. They're living near the town of Shechem. Those who were on the fellowship trip, Scott Shapiro, Chaim, Suzanne, and Marvin, you guys remember we went out to an overlook. We went to overlooking the town of Nablus, which is Shechem. That's the Hebrew word Shechem. The Arab name is Nablus. It's a Palestinian Authority-controlled town now. It's where Yosef is buried, by the way. Joseph, biblical Joseph. So we saw it from a hilltop. We did not have a full military escort to go down and walk through the city. So it's dangerous now, and apparently it was dangerous then. Leah goes out there, and she's seen by the prince, basically the son of the leader, the chieftain. He takes her, brings her into his castle, house, whatever it is, and rapes her. Okay? Nice. All right? Then, now he has a great idea. Apparently, he's enamored by her. So he wants to turn this rape victim into a wife. And he tells his dad, get me this girl for a wife. Okay? So we're going to, she's amazing. Whatever. Okay? All right. Now we have Yaakov hears this what went down. Now, meanwhile, where is Dina right now? Where is Dina right now in the story? Anybody know? Where is Dina right now? Look at the story. Make sure you get the facts. Where is Dina located? Say it again.
She's still in Shechem.
She's still in Shechem. She's still locked in Shechem's house. Okay? So she's not only has she been raped, she's been abducted and incarcerated. She's not free to go. She can't say, thank you, but no thanks. In other words, he wants her to be his, he wants her to be his wife. And, she does not get a vote on this thing. He goes to dad to negotiate it that this should happen, okay? So right now the scene is Dina's stuck in Shechem's house, okay? Shechem wants to marry her. News travels out. Yaakov hears about the rape. The brothers are out in the fields shepherding all the flocks of sheep and cattle. And then it says he's staying there silent until they get home. Okay? So question number four is why would Yaakov remain silent and wait until his sons return home? He's just waiting silently.
Maybe he's grieving a little bit.
I'm sure he's grieving. Yeah, I'm sure he is. But he's silent. He's not doing anything. He's not doing anything. No reaction. He's waiting until the brothers get home. What other reason? No doubt he's grieving.
His emotions in check, like not to get angry, not to be outwardly angry, to kind of keep your emotions balanced for the time being.
Okay, first of all, yes, keep his emotions balanced. Yes, that's clearly going on there. He's like silent. He's quiet. He's sort of like being. But why is he waiting for the brothers to get home?
Something to come up with a plan.
Waiting for backup.
Well, first of all, yeah, he's not, as a elderly man, he's not going to go in and, deal with Shechem by themselves. And as Alan pointed out, when you have a problem, you need to do what? You need to remain calm, develop a strategic plan, you know, talk it out, and of course, do it with the best expert opinions you can gather, which in his case is his sons who are, I guess, in their 20s, right? And discuss it out, what the plan of attack is, right? And don't do anything. Now, that one little half a sentence, what critical life habit does it teach us? This is critical. Critical. If you learn nothing but this half a pasuk tonight, and you take it to heart, your life will be improved. What life habit does it teach us?
Not to react emotionally right away. Thank you. How many people send off an email with some anger in it instead of just sitting and waiting before they send off that email and cause themselves a lot of trouble? So it's really a matter of really taking a step back, thinking about it, and thinking of a strategy as to how to respond.
Correct. Especially, but again, could you just start to process for a moment. How would you feel if your only daughter went out for an innocent walk, was abducted, raped, and ain't coming home? And you don't. And the truth is, she is under control of the local regional power. I mean, how would you, as a father, feel? You'd be freaking out. You'd be completely devastated. You'd be angry. You might be screaming and yelling and crying and everything. I would imagine a person would be completely, and there's no police. There is no law of the land. You know who has the law of the land? Hamor, which is the Hivi chieftains, he's the law of the land. You know what I'm saying? So your life just got shattered here, guys. So the fact that he was able to gather himself, wait silently till the brothers come in and to discuss it and what to do if you can accomplish that or even partially, that is a powerful life skill. I'm going to make it a little bit less dramatic than the Parsha, but something more practical. I created a sort of a narrative. Here we go. Miriam MJ Ear is breaking up with Joe Cohen. It happens. After telling him the difficult news, he explodes with a tirade of insults, hitting all of her buttons. Okay? Apparently, he did not want to break up. A. How do you think Miriam will respond?
They're going to get into a huge argument and she'll storm off?
Right. So if she will probably retaliate with her own tirade of insults.
Right.
In other words, she's going to double down. You know what I mean? After he repudiates her in every kind of way, because he knows her, obviously they had a real strong relationship, she will explode back at him and shower him with a tirade of insults. Okay? And what will be the consequence of that, Suzanne?
This would be very ugly if she responds that way. And I think ultimately she would end up feeling badly because she would, I don't know, maybe I'm thinking of this too much, but realizing that he's just responding because his feelings are hurt. So it would just be very ugly and uncomfortable for everyone.
Right, and make a bad situation worse. Let's say they're part of the same Jewish community. One of the most difficult things that I've had to deal with Rabbi Wiles over the 14 years at MJE is when you have a MJE couple that are dating for a while and they really dig each other and then they break up and it's messy. You know what I'm saying? And then it sort of leaks and then it becomes like who's with which part person, and it starts to divide the community up. Are you friends with the girl? Are you friends with the guy? And who do you think was really correct? And it becomes like a whole mess that you have no idea how many hours myself, Rabbi Wild, had to deal with this kind of insanity, okay? And I had to make deal, and I'm not going to go when he's there, and I was there first. It was, you know, it's an explosion that just never ends, okay? I had somebody not join the fellowship because they broke up with another person in the fellowship a week before the fellowship. Thanks. Yeah. Not good. Okay? True story. Not good. We've had 14 years. I'm not going to say which year it was. But it's really sad because the truth is they were both great people on their own. Both could have benefited from the program. And because of this, you know, very ugly breakup, one person couldn't do it. You know what I mean? Whatever. So now, based upon Yaakov's example, how should Miriam respond when Joe Cohen unleashes a tirade of insults? What should she do? What should she do?
Just not, like, stoop to his level. Just, you know, walk away.
Yeah, basically say something like, Joe.
Like, this is obviously why
Joe,
I'm breaking up.
Joe,
you're proving my point.
Well, no, that's an attack. No, that's a gut punch. Say, Joe.
I can't help it.
Right, you gotta get it. Say, Joe, I know that you're upset. I'm gonna leave now. That's it. No comment. And that's it.
Is that even like a little dig?
No dig. Walk away. But again, remember Yaakov's a black belt of his emotions. But why is it so difficult? Because when you get hurt, in order to defend your sense of self, you want to retaliate to reestablish your sense of significance. So when you get a devastating, kick to the gut, you want to it's very natural to react back. And if you do have the skill to remain centered and not and again, there's always, if there's something to talk about with Joe, there's always next week when he's calmed down, or 2 weeks. You know what I'm saying? And when a person's angry, they lose their mind. You know, in a certain sense, when Joe gets angry, Joe's really not there. Okay. All right. So this is just a critical life hack that you want to be able, because life is going to throw you curveballs. You're going to get insulted by your boss, and you want to yell. You may want to yell at that him or her. Not a good idea. You're going to get embarrassed by people, and you're going to want to, retaliate. You might get into fights with members of your own family and want to retell, and people have a memory that goes back to the moment of creation. So they don't forget. People don't forget and generally do not forgive. That's the bottom line. So that's the bottom. If you can do it, say nothing and just walk out, that's the move. If you can do it, that's a black, now I'm telling you right now, that's a black belt move. It's a black belt move. You got it. Okay. Let's go on.
What's the fine line between a black belt move and being a pushover?
No, because a pushover means that you will, if there are issues that are really need to be addressed, you want to wait till A, you're calmed down, and B, when they're calmed down, and have a real conversation about the issues. Right now, that person, Joe Cohen in our scenario, is currently insane. You can't talk to him.
I mean, isn't there a proverb about a wise man? No, and his temper or something like that.
There are many. I mean, basically, When you're a wise man, when they get angry, lose their wisdom. That's a statement. A wise man, when he gets angry, loses wisdom. When a prophet gets angry, loses prophecy. So it basically means that anger, you become obsessed and controlled by this instinctual force. All your strength is, all your intellectual strength has been drained out of you.
What do you say to Joe when he says, you know, you're avoiding the problem, you always walk away when I get angry, we never solve the problem?
So if if Joe Cohen's going to say, well, first of all, obviously the scenario was when he got dumped. Now, I don't know, in my scenario, I didn't break it out, maybe that she, you know, did she do it well? Did she not do it well? Obviously, when you're bringing that kind of news to somebody, you know, nobody can say, well, thank you very much. Nobody, it's a powerfully rejecting moment. And, you know, it's something that it's a very vulnerable moment. So it's understandable why Joe said that. And Joe's, you know, whatever he's going to say, it's just not productive to have the conversation now. And you just say, Joe, you might just say, it's not a good time to have a conversation. I see that you're very upset. And maybe we'll talk about this at a better time. And then just leave. That's it. There's nothing you can do. Because Joe, my key point is that because Joe's not there, you're wasting your time. And worse, they'll just say things worse and it'll just make him more aggressively angry. So that's the key point. All right, let's keep on going. Let's continue on with the story. All right, so the story is, the scene is, let's keep on going. All right, we go on. Let's have, let's have Suzanne read it out. Meanwhile,
Shem's father, Hamor, came to Jacob to speak with him. Jacob's sons returned from the field. When they heard what had happened, the men were shocked and they seethed with anger. Shem had committed an outrage against Israel, sleeping with a daughter of Jacob. Such an act could not be tolerated. Hamor tried to reason with them. My son Shem is deeply in love with your daughter, he said, if you would let him marry her. Set the bridal payment and gifts as high as you like. I will give you whatever you demand of me. Just let me have the girl as my wife. When Jacob's sons replied to Shem and his father Hamor with deceit and spoke because he had defiled Dinah, their sister, we can't do that, they said. Giving our sister to an uncircumcised man would be a disgrace to us. The only way we can possibly agree is if you will be like us and circumcise every male. Since he desired Jacob's daughter, the young man lost no time in doing it. He was the most respected person in his father's house. On the third day, when the people were in agony, two of Jacob's sons, Shimon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, took up their swords. They came to the city without arousing suspicion and killed every male. They also killed Hamor and his son Shem by the sword and took Dinah from Shem's house. Then they left. Jacob said to Shimon and Levi, you have gotten me in trouble, giving me a bad reputation among the Canaanites and Perizzites who live in the land. I have only a small number of men. They can band together and attack me and my family, and I will be wiped out. Should he have been allowed to treat our sister like a prostitute, they replied.
Okay, then the story ends dramatically. All right. All right, so everybody got what went down. So meanwhile, they cook up a plan, okay? Then Shechem's dad, Hamor, the chieftain, comes to talk to the Jew, you know, the head of the family, Yaakov, and make a deal, because, as he said, his wife, you know, and I cut out some parts of the story. You can go back to the Chumash. I don't want to keep it that long. Because Hamor and Shechem go and negotiate with their own people because, you know, they have to they're not getting Dina, so why should all the men circumcise as adults? So he says, no, we'll be like one family and we'll trade. And he says, isn't their cattle ours already? In other words, he basically makes the illusion that basically by coming together, they're going to become enriched. Now, Are they going to be enriched because of great trade or enriched due to some duplicative motivation? But basically, Shechem and Hamor do the sale, get all the men to do circumcision. Day three, I spoke to a person who does circumcision, and in fact, day three is the hardest day in getting better. Thank God I was 8 days old when that happened. I do not remember. But so they were there. Now, according to one commentator, the Ralbag, the way that Shimon and Levi went and able to kill all the men, they went Mossad-like. They came to the house, knocked on the door. The woman opened the door and says, we know that your husband has done circumcision. We're here to give him some treatment so he'll have an easier time. And they showed him into the bedroom. They quietly kill him, and they tell the people outside, says, it's very important, you're very quiet, and let him sleep. Okay, we gave him some medicine. Okay, and they went house to house, they did all this, and they basically killed all the men of the city, of the town of Shechem. Okay, and then, all right, and then, Then the brothers come in and they take all the stuff afterwards. Okay, that's another fact. Okay, so here let's break it down step by step. This is a very troubling story for all the obvious reasons. Okay, here a troubling story. Here we go. What was Yaakov and the brothers' original plan about rescuing Dinah? What was the original plan? What was their angle?
See, like every man would get circumcised and they would get a fair price for their sister.
But it says with deceit, which means they didn't really want the deal. They wanted Dinah back. So what was the whole bris milah plan?
They were just buying time.
Well, how are you going to buy time in order to cheat in their control?
They were trying to disable the men because they were shorter in numbers and they had larger numbers. So they had to disarm them in a way that they could attack them.
Well, what was the original plan that Yaakov agreed to? You have to work it out logically. Because you see, he's angry. He didn't want them to massacre everybody. What was Yaakov's plan which did not include killing anybody? Anybody can figure it out. It's a little bit logical. The goal is to rescue Dinah and not really become one tribe with the Hivi tribe. What was Yaakov's original plan? Think it out logically, guys.
To kill all the men.
But you see that Yaakov's upset at them for doing that. So his idea was to get Dinah back without killing all the men. So what must have been Yaakov's plan? Albeit deceitful plan.
That the other guy wouldn't go through with having all the males circumcised?
Right, so number one is that by asking, you know, How interested do you think that adult men are having circumcision, you know, which they have to do to themselves if they're in the ages of their 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, and 60s?
They're not going to be too enthused.
No. So they basically says, we'll only do it if everybody does circumcision. So basically they offered a deal that they thought they could not accept. Oh, so you can't do bris milah? So give us back our sister, our daughter. The idea was that either A, that they're going to offer the circumcision deal, they're not going to do it, and if by remote crazy chance they are going to do the bris milah, they're going to circumcise themselves. Then on day three, what would they do? They go in there. Do a Mossad-like raid, get Dina, because nobody can really oppose you because they're in pain in bed. Get Dina back, and nobody dies. That was Yako's plan. Either the deal was going to be so painfully not worth it that they'd say, fine, you take your sister, you take your daughter back, we're out, we're done. Or if they're going to do the Mila, if they're going to do the circumcision, then they'll just go in there. They'll be able to, they'll have nobody stopping them. They'll do a rescue, pull her out, and that's it. But Shimon and Levi did not follow the plan. They apparently had their own plan. And their own plan include, seemingly, a revenge killing. Right? They killed all the men. Now, right? That's how they went off script. Right? They didn't follow the plan. Because you see that their dad is angry at them. Okay? Now, what is... why? Now, here's very careful. We got to take it step by step. Why is, on the surface, on the initial reaction, why is Yaakov... what's his initial reaction to them killing all the people of Shechem? What's his reaction to that? Is he supportive of that?
No, you made the family look bad.
Is his fear only being looked bad? No, it's that's not his...
Well, I mean, it was bad.
Yeah. Okay, so but what's his claim? What's his problem? Suzanne, you're on mute. I can't hear you.
He could be attacked and he could be wiped out because they don't have the numbers.
Right, so he says, his argument is not a criticism of morality that you did an evil thing. He says his argument is an argument of strategy. Guys, what are you nuts? If you're going to attack this city, well, Shechem, I mean, the Hamor, as the chieftain, no doubt has friends in the neighborhood. All the other tribes are going to get together, and they're going to wipe out the Jewish people. Right? You're putting us in tremendous danger. What the heck are you guys doing? That's his argument, right? And then, what was the argument that, this is very critical, what was the argument that Shimon and Levi come back with their dad? What's their argument back to him?
Well, you were dissed, by our sister being raped. And so it's our family dignity and honor that's at stake.
So is their problem, is their claim that such a dishonorable slight, such a demoralizing action cannot be left unresponded to? But what's their deeper argument back to Yaakov? Is it purely because of honor and glory that they dishonored us? They're making a more subtle argument here.
I mean, it's the point that if we don't stop them here, what else could they do? We have to show that we can retaliate and that we have the power to do that. Otherwise, people are going to continue to mess with us.
Alan, exactly correct. Basically, he's doing a... they said, these guys are criminal people. Who just takes a girl who went on a wonderful little walk, abducts her, rapes her, and comes and says, give us money so she could be our wife? You know what I mean? What is that? So these people are lowlifes. So if they can do that because they felt like that, if we don't do, shall we say, a little shock and awe, if we don't do shock and awe, we're going to be victimized left, right, and center. It's an argument from a deterrent standpoint. That's their argument back to their father. Okay? Now,
Robin, I know I'm late to the conversation, but for the purpose of the whole conversation, we're assuming that the interpretation that she was raped is valid?
Yeah, she was raped. Nobody's... in fact, the Midrash says not only was she raped, they go further, she was raped both with normal sex and anal sex, according to the Midrash. So that's, you know, so she was, that's why he says the word vayaneh, she was afflicted. It was like, it wasn't like a, it was bad. Okay? So, okay, yeah.
Because I've heard other interpretations of it that kind of twisted a little bit there, but we won't get into that.
Well, he clearly slept with her.
That is not debated.
Right, and he kept her incarcerated, and sent his dad to negotiate a deal so he can keep her as his wife. Those are the facts as the story is presented. So we have Yaakov's reaction that you're going to get us killed because basically all the allies of Shechem and Hamor are going to come and they're going to wipe us out, and Jewish history will end right here. And Shimon Levy's response says, "What, you could treat our sister like a prostitute?" As Alan pointed out, their argument could be understood as, "This is, if you're living in a dangerous neighborhood, and the bully comes to you, you punch him in the nose, or you got to do a little shock and awe. You're gonna start taking stuff. You're gonna get victimized left, right, and center. This is not the end. This is the beginning." That's their argument. Now, the story is not over. But here's the question. Bring back our little Joe Cohen story. We bring Joe Cohen back in for another round. After Joe Cohen's barrage of insults, Miriam stops to think. She tells herself, "It's not good for Joe that I let him off the hook. I have to do the mitzvah of rebuking him. I can't let other women have to go through this." Then she leaves. Then she leashes a barrage of her own. Okay? Now, her argument of correcting him and criticizing him is that she is really rebuking him. She's not insulting him. She's involved in a mitzvah of rebuke. Okay? Is that strategy more like Yaakov or his sons?
Obviously more like the sons.
Right. In other words, the claim is that you're doing something for a mitzvah. But is that really why Miriam's yelling at Joe? Is it about the mitzvah?
About getting back.
Right. See, in fact, it's a smarter way of revenge. In other words, you can't hijack the Torah for your own agenda. And in our scenario, Miriam could make her feel justified that she is what? That she is correcting and pointing out the defects and flaws of Joe Cohen's points. It's not about really improving him. It's a way to subtly, or quote-unquote not so subtly, counterattack him using religion as a shield. Okay? Now, the story, this is chapter 34. Fast forward many decades later. Yaakov is on his deathbed. He is in his deathbed in Egypt. All the brothers are standing around his bed, and Yaakov is giving his final blessings to the brothers. And this is what he says to Shimon and Levi. Marvin Bound, read us out here. Take us home.
Shimon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are weapons of violence. My soul do not come into their council. My glory do not be united with their assembly. For in their anger they killed men. In their self-will they hamstrung cattle. Cursed be their anger, for it was fierce. And their wrath, for it was cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel.
Okay, so here is an absolute powerful repudiation. The Ramban, read a little more. Start from, I've already explained.
I've already explained that Jacob became angry at Shimon and Levi when they killed the men of Shechem because they had thereby committed an injustice. For the Shechemites had done nothing wrong to the sons of Jacob at all, and they entered into the covenant undergoing circumcision. perhaps they would have repented to God, and they would have become included among the men of the house of Abraham and among the souls they had made in Haran. Another reason Jacob was angry with them was that he wanted that people should not say that in the matter of the attack on Shechem was done under his advice, for it would constitute a desecration of God's name if the prophet Jacob would commit an act of injustice and plunder, even if only by proxy. This is the reason for Jacob's words in the next verse. Into their conspiracy my soul did not enter, with their congregation my spirit did not join.
Okay, so here we see clearly the way that the Ramban, Nachmanides, learns it is that his blessing, i.e., which is here a curse, which is the question why that's, is what? Is a powerful repudiation. You got it? In other words, they made a deal. It could have that their bris milah is the first step to actually becoming followers of Avram. You could have had a positive impact. But you took their trust, and you killed them. So, it's very nice you had your, in other words, it may have said, you may have had your political argument of deterrence. You may have had all your justifications, but bottom line, what? Underneath the justification, what was lurking? What is Yaakov saying was lurking behind there? What was underneath all their justifications?
They acted in anger.
Yeah. They had a murderous rage, which they justified with the claims of deterrence. Or whatever, you know, or... Yeah, it's not right, whatever. As some sort of... In reality, they did not... Their motive, their claims were innocent, but their motives were evil. And that's what... And now, Yaakov does not tell them them. He tells them at the end of the life. Now, something very interesting. At the end of the life of Yaakov, he tells Shimon Levi his true assessment of their actions. Was he impressed by their arguments? Obviously not. Now, here's a key question. Why, if not why, did he not tell them like Miriam immediately after the event? Remember, his response to them initially was what? Only pragmatic. What are you doing? You're going to get us all killed. He doesn't say that your anger is cursed. He does not say to them then. Why is that? Why does he wait decades later to talk to Shimon and Levi that... as was read, your swords are weapons of violence. My soul did not come into your council. My glory will not be united in their assembly. For in their anger, they killed men. Why didn't he lay that into them right away? Why did he wait decades to say this?
Maybe he wanted to see if they would acknowledge their mistake and maybe change their behavior.
Oh, so you're saying that he was waiting for them to come to the awareness. Okay, it's good. What else? What other reasons could he have to wait so many years?
I mean, so they don't get angry at him and try to attack him or attack someone else.
Right, because remember, Yaakov was on his deathbed. When you're listening to somebody on your deathbed, especially... His last words with them, which is prophetically inspired, you're taking it very seriously. Basically, he didn't criticize their anger because their anger was a very core flaw, and they were not ready to address that. So this is the last chance. Now, so he told them when they could hear it. That's a very important point. We have friends, we have family. Just because they have a flaw or a defect does not mean they can handle that truth. To quote Jack Nicholson, you want the truth, you cannot handle the truth. Now, there I will end the story. There is a positive ending to the story. So, and that's why it's called a blessing. Yaakov's blessing... This is called a blessing. Now, how could Yaakov talking that his two sons are involved in violence? Why is that a blessing? It's a blessing because if you can recognize your flaw, embrace that defect and do tshuva and redeem yourself, that's fantastic. That's growth. And interestingly enough, the tribe of Levi is selected to be the tribe that does the service in the temple, in the Mishkan. Why? Because there was another event later in Jewish history called the Sin of the Golden Calf. The Jews fell down into idolatry. Moshe calls out, who's going to help me prosecute and kill the people involved in this terrible sin of idolatry? Who steps forward? The tribe of Levi. In other words, it's not, a person can be honest and say, I have a very aggressive side. That's not a problem. The question is, how do you direct your aggressive side? So, obviously, Shimon and Levi, using their aggressiveness and wiping out, massacring the men of Shechem, evil. Using that to be to dedicate that to, whether it be in war or whether it be in a case of where justice has to be done and done in a proper manner, that's a good thing. The Talmud states that a person has an aggressive, very aggressive nature, they should take as a profession the job of a ritual slaughterer. In other words, express that, and of course, Suzanne's against that, the key principle being express that aggressiveness positively so it does not hurt people. You might say use something else, or we might say do sports, whatever. Whatever, the key point is, be honest with your emotions, direct them positively. Levi, even though they sunk low, they ultimately redeemed themselves and they went high. And they're able to become the leaders of the service to God in the Jewish people because they had heard the words of Yaakov. They recognize they have a weakness. They recognize they have a flaw. But they directed that, they did tshuva, they returned, they redeemed themselves, and they're directing that defect in a positive way. Take a negative element, direct it positively. If you have aggressive instinct, use, as they say, lay it, keep it on the field. In other words, play ball. Get that aggressiveness out in a positive manner. And even though this was a terrible chapter in Jewish history, it ultimately had a positive thing. So I'm going to now, a quick 60-second summary. We start off the class with a debate about is the assassination of the top Iranian nuclear scientist good or bad? We have one is bad for the Biden administration, their interests of foreign policy toward Iran, while the general says from a Israel standpoint, it is both A, will slow down the nuclear progress toward a bomb, and B, will provide a powerful deterrence of Iran against Israel. That's point number one. Point number two, we had the episode that when Yaakov heard the terrible, terrible news, he was silent until the brothers came home. Because if you are angry and you just act, you're going to regret it. If Yaakov would have went screaming to himself and ran into the city of Shechem himself, he could have got himself killed. Rather, quietly discuss the issue, work out a plan. The plan was to create a deal that they could offer a deal so difficult that they could not accept, and therefore they get their sister back. They did not do it, so the plan B was, when they're weak, take Dina from the weakened, recovering people of Shechem. Shimon and Levi, who had albeit a very powerful argument of, we got to show who's the toughest guy on the block, a deterrent strategy, they took Dina and they killed all the men. Yako was angry at them initially for tactical reasons. You're going to get us killed. And then on his deathbed, shares him what he really thinks about that. That they did an act of injustice, and that it'll be a chilul Hashem. He just lays into them. But it ends with a positive thing, because at least the tribe of Levi, not tribe of Shimon, tribe of Levi, absorbed that criticism and redeemed themselves by able to express that powerful, aggressive instinct in a positive way, to be involved as the enforcer of justice and not massacring innocent people. And that's a lesson for all of us, because one is that we have to be on guard that we might use religion and Judaism as a way to cover our real nefarious interests and instincts to get back at people, A. And B is the recognition that if I have a flaw and I'm going to work on it and I'm able to direct that aggressiveness positively, that could be a good thing. So ultimately, the tribe of Levi went low but redeemed themselves, and then they went high. And that's some of the lessons, and there are many, from this week's Parsha. Questions?
The tribe of Levi redeemed themselves, but Shimon
didn't? Shimon did not. Shimon, in fact, when there was the episode of the when Jews got involved in the women of Moab and Midian, and they worshipped Baal Peor, it was mostly what? It was mostly the tribe of Shimon, and they were basically blowing off Moshe's authority, and they basically acted in a rather a rash and aggressive way, and they did not seem to learn that lesson. So that's also a point in life, you know what I mean? Some people, as they say, they just don't learn. You know what I mean? You see them in words, you know, there are people, we all know them, that their life is just an endless Groundhog Day. They make a mistake, they make it again, they make it again, they make it, and they suffer every single time. They make the same mistake, they suffer, and they suffer, and they suffer, and they do not learn. And that's also reality. They don't, and that's also tragic. So, also part of life. So, another lesson, but a lot of lessons in the Parsha. Any other questions before we go?
I was just going to say that there does seem to be a definite difference between what Israel did with Iran. Iran is a clear enemy, whereas in the case of Shem, they were trying to be friends, so to speak, after they did something horrible, but they were trying to make up for it by having everybody in the community, innocent people, circumcised to become part of the Jewish nation. So it seems that there is some difference here. Israel has that existential threat that Shem did not present.
Correct. So Yaakov agrees with you, Marvin. He agrees that assessment, but the brothers claimed that they were not. They were really an aggressor, and everything they said nicely was really a trick, and they're all full of it. And bottom line is, you're in a dangerous neighborhood. You cannot take them on their word, and you got to be tough. Yaakov did not agree with that. He cursed their anger, okay? So that's what that, and that's, I mean, the Ramban is very harsh on the brothers. He's saying, unjust, chil Hashem, he's not, you know, that was their motivation. They may have dressed up their motivation very, very nicely with good arguments. But he's learning from Yaakov's final words. It's not true. It's not true. So that's the deal. Any other questions, everyone? All right, so tomorrow night is the annual Ruth Wildmore lecture, which is available online. Go to MJE, you can sign up and get the link and this and that. And they have none other than Senator Joe Lieberman, who's always great to listen to. He's fantastic, I recommend it. Yeah, it's good. And he's going to share some very interesting stories about his time in the Senate and a lot of good stuff. So and also showing respect and honor to the Wild family who have done so much for us. Okay. Have a great night, everybody. Lila Tove.